Today is the sixth day of our July-August seven-day session. It's the 4th of August 2017. And we're going to take up another story from The Hidden Lamp, Stories from 25 Centuries of Awakened Women, edited by Florence Kaplow and Susan Moon. And the story is entitled Laywoman Pang's Merit. Here's how the story goes. One day, laywoman Pang went into the Deer Gate Temple and made an offering of food. The temple priest asked her on whose behalf she made the offering so that he could transfer its merit to the proper being. Laywoman Pang took out her comb from the side of her bun and stuck it in the back of her hair, and she said, "The transfer of merit is complete," and walked out. So first of all, a little bit about laywoman Pang. We don't know her name. She's just referred to as laywoman Pang, or sometimes Mrs. Pang. And this story that we've just read is recorded in the Pang Chu Shi, which is the recorded sayings of layman Pang. His dates are 740 to 808, and his wife appears in some of the stories, and also their two children. They had a daughter called Ling Zhao, which means spirit shining, and about 762, and also a son, Geng Huo. We don't know so much about him. Ling Zhao is said to have taken after her father. She loved books, and she would read with her father and debate with him about the contents. They lived in Hengyang in southern Hunan province, and they were quite comfortably well off. Pang's father was a wealthy government official, and Layman Pang himself was also some kind of minor official in the Chinese administration. When Ling Zhao was about 18, Layman Pang donated their house to a temple, and then took all their possessions and wealth and money out in a boat into the middle of a lake and dumped them all. The record doesn't relate whether Mrs. Pang or the children had any say in this. In Tang Dynasty China, of course, where Confucianism was still strong and stayed strong for centuries and centuries, probably the thoughts and feelings of a man's wife and children would be considered completely irrelevant in the situation. But they appear to have taken it in their stride. This brought to mind the story that's told of Tolstoy, who was an aristocrat with a large estate, a count, in fact, under the Tsar. And he had a kind of awakening experience, a turnaround, where he became, his beliefs became sort of like a Christian anarchist, you could say. And he started to dress in peasant's clothing and rejected his own wealth. He relinquished the copyright he had on his books, his early books, which of course was a source of wealth, and started to treat the serfs on his property as equals. And apparently, this is all very high-minded, of course, but apparently it was extremely traumatic to his wife and children to suddenly find that they were virtually penniless. And you could take this as an indication that Tolstoy was had become somewhat stuck in emptiness on the side of quality, and therefore had just completely really disregarded the wishes and needs of his family in making this renunciation. It wasn't really entirely his to make, and yet that's what happened. Being the head of the household, he could do that. And I wonder about Leman Pang, whether there wasn't something of this in his actions. But apparently, his family was not traumatized. They joined him in his new state. And at one point, he wrote a verse to describe this new found freedom that he and his family had discovered. He wrote, "My boy has no bride, my girl has no groom. Forming a happy family circle, we speak about the birthless." So he was really going against the conventions of the day, in which it was the sacred duty of a father to marry off one's children, and in so doing to not only to continue the family line, but also to produce heirs who would take care of offerings at the family altar. And what Lama Pang is saying here is that they were focused on something entirely different from this endeavor. Forming a happy family circle, we speak about the birthless. What is beyond producing heirs and making offerings at the family shrine? Ling Zhao joined her father in his travels around China, engaging in Dharma dialogue with masters and temples. They apparently sold bamboo baskets to earn a living. And we don't hear very much about what happened to Mrs. Pang when they were Ling Zhao and her father were travelling around. But I wonder if she maybe was the one who made the baskets that supported the family in the pilgrimage of those two. There's a famous story about when Leman Pang died. I'm reading now from Zen's Chinese Heritage by Andy Ferguson. When Laman Pang was about to die, he said to his daughter Ling Zhao, "Go and look at the sun and see what time it is. Just when it's noon, come and tell me." Ling Zhao went to the door and looked out, saying, "The sun has just reached noon, but there's an eclipse." When Laman Pang went to the door and looked out, Ling Zhao went to her father's seat, placed her hands together, and passed away. Laman Pang smiled and said, "Ha ha, my daughter's deftness." In another translation, it says, "My daughter beats me, as always." He then postponed his departure from the world by 7 days. The governor of Shangzhou came to visit Pang Yun and ask about his illness. Laman Pang said to him, "I ask that you regard everything that is as empty, nor give substance to that which has none. Farewell. The world is like reflections and echoes." Then, placing his head on the governor's knee, Laman Pang passed away. His cremated remains were cast upon rivers and lakes. Monks and laity mourned him, saying that he was actually Vimalakirti. 300 of Laman Pang's poems were left to spread through the world. Of course, this is exceedingly high praise, Vimalakirti being the great enlightened bodhisattva layman in the Vimalakirti Sutra. You can heed his Laman Pang's advice on his death. "I ask that you regard everything that is as empty, nor give substance to that which has none. Farewell. The world is like reflections and echoes." In some later elaborations of this story, Mrs. Pang and her son are also in it and die along with Laman Pang and Ling Zhao. Starts to be a little bit unplausible at that point. Anyhow, Mrs. Pang, laywoman Pang, is really, you can class her as one of the unsung women that we refer to in our dedication for our ancestral line. We can't say she's unknown because we do have these stories about her, but she's sort of in the shadow of her husband. So back to our story now. So laywoman Pang goes to a temple to make a food offering. And the temple priest wants to know on whose behalf she's making the offering so that he can transfer the merit. And this apparently involved writing the name or the description of the offering, the name of the person who was making it, the person for whom it was being offered, and the date in a big ledger, kind of register. But in response to the temple priest's question, which he would have just routinely asked people when they brought food to the temple, she took out her comb from the side of her bun. She had long black hair that was wound up on top of her head. She took out the comb and stuck it in the back of her hair and said, "Transfer of merit is complete," and then walked out. So, of course, as people I'm sure know, the traditional role for lay people in classical Buddhism and in many Theravadan countries today, is to offer food. And this is seen as a profound practice of dana, generosity. And it's seen often as being a way of making merit by lay people, by supporting the monks who were, you could sort of say, professional meditators. Then they were, those lay people were generating merit, which would lead to their eventual rebirth in celestial realms and heavenly realms, or in circumstances in which they could themselves become monks. And it was generally accepted that you needed to leave home in order to engage in really serious practice and to awaken. Of course, the Pan family were really exceptions to this. None of them ordained, obviously. But they did, Layman Pang certainly, and probably Ling Zhao at least, did spend plenty of time at monasteries training under masters. Layman Pang trained under Shirtol and Matsu, the great Matsu, as well as doing solo retreats and going on pilgrimage. In the present time, we could think of, some people may be familiar with I think originally she was Burmese, but came to live in India, I think in Calcutta, a teacher, great Vipassana teacher, Deepa Ma, who lived in a tiny one-bedroom apartment in Calcutta, and with a daughter and a daughter's child, and taught all those around her, all the neighbours in her apartment building, had them doing Vipassana practice and awakening. So there are these examples. And we all are examples of this, coming in periodically to live as temporary monastics when we do sesshin, and then returning to our lives beyond the walls of the monastery. So the monk asks Mrs. Pang, who should I transfer the merit to? Of course, this transferring merit is a part of our practice. We do it every day when we do the Honzon Echo, the return of merit. We say we return the merit of our chanting to Shakyamuni Buddha, Manjushri Bodhisattva, Avalokita Bodhisattva, Bahadra Bodhisattva. This has been done throughout the history of Mahayana, and it's seen as being a kind of antidote to spiritual materialism. Instead of greedily trying to accumulate merit for ourselves, we give it away. This is what it says about this in the Encyclopedia of Eastern Philosophy and Religion. This is under punya, which is the Sanskrit term for merit, punna in Pali. This term generally refers to the karmic merit gained through giving alms, performing pujas, that's offerings, reciting sutras and so on, which is said to assure a better life in the future. Accumulating merit is a major factor in the spiritual effort of a Buddhist layperson. The Mahayana criticizes the egoistic accumulation of merit in the Hinayana and teaches that accumulated merit should serve the enlightenment of all beings by being transferred to others. The commitment to transfer a part of one's accumulated merit to others is a significant aspect of the Bodhisattva vow. Perfection in this is achieved in the eighth stage of a Bodhisattva's development, so very far on in terms of the process of awakening, the eighth stage of a Bodhisattva. So really giving away our merit can be experienced as being quite challenging. So what is Mrs. Pang doing when her response to the priest's question is to move her comb from one part of her head to the other part? This story is quite a lot more koan-like than some of the other stories in the book. And if we were taking up this koan, then this understanding Mrs. Pang's action would be the nub. What is she expressing when she moves her comb? The comb moves, but what is transferred to what? When I first started practicing and started to do the return of merit, it puzzled me a little why we were returning the merit to the Buddha and the Bodhisattvas. Surely they had plenty of it already. In fact, just buckets. Whereas I felt like I had very little merit. But then it dawned on me that I'm not separate from the Buddha or Kanon or Manjushri or Samantabhadra. These beings are my own enlightened mind, compassion and wisdom, skill. So really, in a sense, I was dedicating that merit to the best part of myself, and of course the word part doesn't capture it. But somehow I was, in doing that return of merit, I'm affirming my most noble aspirations, emphasizing that rather than that narrow feeling of wanting to gain something from spiritual practice. Mrs. Pang, when she makes this silent gesture, is responding out of the same aspect of herself, out of a vast mind that encompasses all beings, all things. She's not concerned about making sure that the right sum is recorded in the merit ledger. She's not counting at all, actually. She's just freely offering the food. No strings attached. she's not only offering food, but she's offering teaching to this monk. And we can take her teaching to heart ourselves, this freely offered teaching, as we practice right here in Sesheng. It can be enormously helpful and actually a relief when we start to practice in the spirit of dana, when we see that our practice is a kind of offering, not some kind of quid pro quo, but just offered. If we have got in mind, in the back of our mind somewhere, an idea of what we're going to get out of what we put in, then we'll get disappointed at some point, because it never unfolds as we think. We may get in that very painful feeling of, look how much effort I've put in, how much I've given, and surely by now my practice should be like X, Y, Z. Mrs. Pang just gives, and she gives out of a deep understanding that she and the monks she's nourishing are not separate. She understands that when the monks at the temple eat, she's nourished. When they're enlightened, she's enlightened. There's an exchange between a master his name is Hui Hai, and I wasn't able to check it, not having a lot of reference books here, but it roughly goes like this from memory. A monk comes and asks the master, how does one enter the way? And the master says, through the perfection of dana paramita. And then the monk asks, well, why do you mention only dana paramita? Why not the other five paramitas? Sila, ethics, kshanti, patience, etc. And the master replies, all the other ones are contained within the dana paramita of generosity. And then he goes on to say that dana means relinquishment. So he shifts the meaning a little from giving to giving up. And these two are intimately related. They both involve releasing what we hold. And then the monk asks the question, what needs to be relinquished? And Hui Hai goes on to list all these different sets of opposites, dualisms, good and evil, success and failure, has and has not, pure and impure, unenlightened and enlightened. And of course these are the very things that can really plague us, especially on the last day of Sesheng. Having time, no time, beginnings and endings. And then he doesn't mention it, but he implies when he lists all these different sets of dualities, self and other, which underlies all the rest. This is the primary way we divide up the indivisible and the thing that causes us so much distress and anguish. So he's saying that the way is about giving up all the dichotomies, all the dilemmas that pin us down. We can learn from this exchange and from Mrs. Pang to not count, to not check the ledger, not to be asking, how am I doing? Surely I should be concentrated by now. It's day 6. My mind is a mess. Your mind is your mind. Day 6 is just an idea. Or we get into checking the clock, counting up how much time we've been in Sesshin and how much time there is left. But just to give, just to quietly get on with it, just practice, to bring ourselves into accord with the boundless generosity of the universe. Just think of a single tree, the number of leaves on it. Or a field of grass. How many worms would be in that field? There's a piece by Samuel Beckett, and he talks about a ton of worms in an acre. Brian Swim, the cosmologist, in one of his books, he talks about the sun and its unconditional, incessant outpouring of energy. And it's this outpouring of energy, of course, that enables every single life form on our earth to exist, including we human beings. The sun sends its rays across 93 million miles of space to us here on earth. The sun's a million times the size of our earth. And every second, 4 million tons of its mass is converted into energy. Every second, it burns up 4 million tons of itself. Swim says, if it weren't for that ongoing bestowal of energy, we wouldn't have any life on Earth. He calls this burning up of energy, of mass into energy, a great act of cosmic generosity, a vast giveaway that enables all of us to survive, to live. He goes on to say, human generosity is possible only because at the center of the solar system, a magnificent stellar generosity pours forth free energy day and night without stop and without complaint and without the slightest hesitation. And it's not just that the sun can inspire us, but that we partake of that cosmic generosity. We are the sun in human form. and we can match the Son's generosity in our own way. I have another story here which contrasts some with this image of this great sun sustaining us with its body. And this little story also points to the fact that you don't have to be big and powerful and flashy like the sun to be generous. It happened just a few years ago to two young children in a family from Illinois. The 8-year-old daughter became ill and was diagnosed with a life-threatening blood disease. A search went out to find a donor of blood compatible with her own. As she weakened, they looked and no donor could be found. Then it was discovered that her 6-year-old brother shared her rare blood type. The mother and their minister and doctor sat down with the boy to ask if he would be willing to donate his blood to save the life of his sister. Much to their surprise, he did not answer right away. He wanted some time to think about it. 6-year-olds can be quite thoughtful at times. After a few days, he went to his mother and said, "Yes, I'll do it." The following day, the doctor brought both children to his clinic and placed them on cots next to each other. He wanted them to see how one was helping the other. First, he drew a half pint of blood from the young boy's arm. Then he moved it over to his sister's cot and inserted the needle so her brother could see the effect. In a few minutes, color began to pour back into her cheeks. Then the boy motioned for the doctor to come over. He wanted to ask a question very quietly. "Will I start to die right away?" he asked. You see, when he had been asked to donate his blood to save the life of his sister, his 6-year-old mind understood the process literally. That's why he needed a few days to think about it. And then he simply gave what was in the heart of every human being, to give when we are truly connected. We're not being asked to do anything as momentous as this little boy thought he was being asked to do. We're just called upon to give up our delusions, to let them go. To turn towards our Buddha nature. To just give ourselves to this moment. To the breath. To move. To whatever our question is, just without checking, without stepping back to take stock. Every time we return to the practice, we're affirming our connection. Our connections to each other, to human beings, to sentient beings of all kinds, to the insentient, to the sun and the moon and the stars. Every time we do that, turning back to the practice, we're affirming that we're not separate. Every time we shift our attention back to the practice from our thoughts, we are loosening the hold that our delusions have over us. We don't have to do it all in some big dramatic flourish, but just in small, seemingly insignificant steps. Just get on with it. No nonsense, like Lame Woman Pang. We'll stop here and recite the four vows. All beings without number,
I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless fine passions. I vow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow